We're now in Unit 4, three chapters in this unit, and also this is the beginning of the DNA section of the term. For the rest of the term, we'll, one way or another, be talking about DNA, including in this chapter, only not so much in this chapter. This is a chapter that's about the cell cycle, and the cell cycle refers to one lifetime of a cell. I mean the lifetime of one cell. But the reason it's a cycle is because of something we've already talked about before, which is that cells come only from pre-existing cells, right? So it's a cycle because unless a cell gets killed, which of course is possible, if a cell lives a natural lifetime, it will end its own life by splitting and creating two new cells, which is the beginning of a new cell cycle, one for each of those two cells. And so the cell cycle includes cell division. That's really the start-finish line of a cell cycle. And the opening slide is all about, well, it shows you three major reasons why cell division is used in biology by organisms, one of which is reproduction, as you see. Now, if you are a single-celled individual, like a bacterium, for instance, your reproduction is a little bit different from human reproduction. A pregnant woman nowadays usually survives childbirth. In other words, she still exists, but now there is a new mouth to feed. A bacterium or any single-celled individual, by reproducing, ends its own life, right? When one cell splits into two, the original cell no longer exists. But reproduction involves cell division, and that's actually even true for multicellular individuals, right? You all started your life as a single-celled zygote, but it didn't last as a single cell very long. It splits into two, then four, and so on to become the embryo, and eventually the fetus, eventually the baby. Growth and development is shown next. There are two things that are different from each other, but lumped into one. Growth refers to increase in size, of course. Now, an individual cell can grow, in fact has to, right, because when cell division takes place and one cell splits into two, obviously those two cells that result are not full-sized immediately. So they have to grow to the same size as the original cell that split into two. That's not really the growth that's being portrayed here. Growth in multicellular organisms like us does not occur because cells get as big as the individual, right? And that's because there's a constraint put on the size of individual cells. What is that constraint?
Isn't it the surface-to-volume ratio?
Perfect, yes. The surface area to volume ratio constrains cells from getting inordinately or indefinitely big in all three dimensions at once. So we multicellular organisms get big or grow by adding a lot more small cells. And that involves creating those cells, which involves cell division. Development is distinct from growth because you started out as a zygote, for instance, single cell, but now you are not just 100 trillion identical copies of that zygote. You have all kinds of different cells because some of those cells have gone down different developmental pathways compared to the other cells. So you have neurons, hepatocytes, all kinds of different cells. Tissue renewal is the third major reason. And this applies only to multicellular organisms as well, simply because single-celled organisms don't have tissues, right? Tissues is one of the levels in the hierarchical organization of life that we studied back in the first chapter. everything from atoms all the way up to the biosphere. Remember those levels? Tissues is one of those levels. Tissues are made up of cells, but only in multicellular organisms. And tissues can be damaged. If you have a wound, whether it's your skin or any other tissue, millions of cells get destroyed in that process, and they part of the healing is to replace the cells that have been killed, which involves creating new cells, which involves cell division. So all three of these things rely on cell division, which is part of the cell cycle. Let's look at a cell in slide 2. Now, in the dichotomy of cell types, what kind of cell are we looking at? What is it? It is eukaryotic. And you can tell that why? Right, it has a pretty definite nucleus. This is the overall cell, but this is the nucleus within it, and by definition, it must be a eukaryotic cell, therefore. In a eukaryotic cell, what do you find in the nucleus? DNA, yes. And the dark purple strands that you see here do include DNA, but that's not the entire material. We're looking at a material called chromatin. With an N. And chromatin is a mixture, molecularly speaking, of two macromolecule types. Chromatin has DNA plus a bunch of proteins complexed with that DNA. So DNA, of course, is a nucleic acid. Proteins are a second category of macromolecules. So that is the stuff. Chromatin is the stuff that chromosomes are made out of that we'll study more and more as we go on. But you don't see chromosomes here. And we wouldn't use the word chromosomes yet, even though the material is there that makes up chromosomes. So it's just really kind of a word game that we play. We don't use the word chromosome until the chromatin that makes up chromosomes coils up, condenses very tightly to the point that you can distinctly see individual pieces. And those individual pieces are then called chromosomes. Nothing has been added or subtracted for that to happen. It's simply a condensing or a coiling up of the chromatin. But before that happens, the chromatin is very diffuse. I can tell by looking at this picture that this cell is near the end of its own lifetime. This is late in the cell cycle. It's already been through the part of the cell cycle where it does its job being whatever kind of cell it is. But it's gotten to the point in the cell cycle where it's made the decision to prepare to split into two to create two new cells. And I can tell that by looking at the chromatin. Earlier, when this cell was just busy living its life, the nucleus would be visible under a light microscope, but you wouldn't see these thick strands. It would just kind of be a gray background looking through the scope. That's because the DNA that's part of the chromatin in there needs to be accessible. Think back to what the two major functions of DNA are that we've talked about. What are those? No? DNA is not involved in translation. Transcription is one function of DNA. And what's the other? It is. And both of those functions, transcription and replication, require being able to read the code that's in DNA. The sequence of nucleotides that make up DNA is the code. And you can't read the DNA sequence if the chromatin that the DNA is part of is very highly coiled up. That's why DNA doesn't very highly coil up until the cell is about to split in two, because if it didn't coil up, it would be an unmanageable tangle. Anyway, that's how I can tell that this preparation for splitting has started. The chromatin, though, hasn't nearly gotten as compact as it will, because it'll get so compact that you'll see individual pieces that we then call chromosomes. Let's look at a chromosome in slide 3. The photomicrograph is a single chromosome, but it is a replicated chromosome. So remember, we said that transcription and replication are the two functions of DNA. Well, the transcription job of DNA is all about the lifetime of that cell. Any living cell needs to transcribe its DNA, transcribe its genes, for the purpose of eventually making proteins, right? That's transcription and followed by translation. You need the proteins to actually do the jobs in the cell. So DNA is continuously being used during the lifetime, the normal lifetime of that cell. But when the cell then prepares to end its own life and become two new cells, the other major function of DNA comes into play, which is replication. DNA needs to be replicated before cell division happens. Because if a cell is going to successfully divide, by which I mean not just divide, but divide to produce two viable cells, viable meaning able to live, then each of those two cells has to have not only DNA, but all the DNA that the original cell had. You can't give each of the two cells half of the original cell's DNA. You need all of the genes, because you need to be able to make all of the proteins that are required. So the only way for that to happen is if, before splitting, the original cell makes a total copy of all of its DNA, so it can give each of the two cells a full DNA library. That's where replication comes in, as a preparation for cell division. We can see this in cartoon form. Any given species has a certain number of chromosomes, and it just depends on the species. This fictitious species, whatever the cell is, has one chromosome. And this top picture is actually a lie, because of what I was telling you earlier. You wouldn't see a condensed chromosome at this point in the cell cycle. It would just be diffuse chromatin, so that the DNA would be accessible for transcription to make the proteins it needs for its life. But just for simplicity, they drew it as a chromosome so you could tell how much DNA we're talking about. And then, as a preparation to split, the DNA gets replicated. So now this one chromosome, that is the only chromosome this species has, is a replicated chromosome, which means it has twice the DNA that it needs. It's enough for two chromosomes, one for each of the two cells that will result from the split. And that's what we're looking at in the micrograph. Okay? Notice on the DNA molecules to the right end, you have one DNA originally up at the top. And keep in mind what I've said earlier about the phrase one DNA. When we talk about one DNA, and we even sometimes say one DNA molecule, it's a single DNA is really two molecules, right? Because each of the two strands is by itself a polynucleotide, which is a molecule. A multimeric protein is not a single molecule, right? Because each of the individual polypeptides is one molecule, but they're complex together. So this double-stranded single DNA is two polynucleotides held together. Well, you double that in replication, and both of those double helices are in this replicated chromosome that we're looking at in the picture. Now, there's several different words that can be easily confused with each other. That's why I said chromatin with an N earlier, because the two halves, which are genetically identical, of this replicated chromosome individually are called chromatids, with a D. Chromatin is simply the stuff that it's made out of. It's DNA and protein. But this one half of the replicated chromosome is a chromatid, and this one is a chromatid. Since they are genetically identical, which means the DNA component is identical, they're called sister chromatids. And since they are still connected into one overall chunk, we consider this to be one chromosome, but it's a replicated chromosome. It's enough material to be two chromosomes, and it will be once the split happens. But when the chromatids are still stuck together, we call this one replicated chromosome. Whereas before the replication, this is one unreplicated chromosome. All right. Now the place on the replicated chromosome where the two sister chromatids connect, holding this thing together, is the centromere. Any given replicated chromosome has a centromere. It's not necessarily in this position along the length, but it's somewhere along the length. Okay. As we see in the cartoon, cell division involves the separation of sister chromatids, and once they separate from each other, we no longer call them chromatids. We call each one an unreplicated chromosome, and it ends up in its own cell. Enough DNA for one cell. Well, in slide 4, we have a schematic representation of the cell cycle I was talking about. So one lap around this circle is a single cell cycle, and the start-finish line is the cell division. All right, so you see two cells here. That's because a cell division has just happened. This one's going to go through its own cell cycle. This one's going through the cell cycle shown here. But that's the beginning of a new cell cycle. And an entire cell cycle, as you can see by the outer band coloring, consists of two primary subphases, one of which is interphase. You can see that's the longer of the two subphases. And then the yellow subphase shown here is the mitotic phase, which can be called the M phase for short. M, of course, stands for mitotic. This is potentially confusing terminology because mitotic is simply the adjective of mitosis, which is a process. But what is somewhat confusing is that the mitotic phase is not the same thing as mitosis. The mitotic phase is named for the fact that it includes mitosis, but it includes more than just mitosis. It includes mitosis and cytokinesis. Okay, so interphase and the mitotic phase together make up one cell cycle. Those are the primary subdivisions. But you have subdivisions within each of those subdivisions, which you can see on the interior. Interphase consists of three subdivisions, G1, S, and G2, as you see. And the G's here stand for gap. So first gap and second gap are what G1 and G2 really were named for, which is kind of unfortunate because the word gap implies that there's really nothing much happening in either of those, and that's not true at all. There's a lot happening. You just don't necessarily see any exciting things under a like microscope, which is why they got named that. But G1, which is the first part of interphase, is the normal lifetime of a cell. That's what I was referring to when I earlier said when the cell is busy doing whatever that kind of cell does. It's living its own life, and the DNA is being used throughout G1 for transcription in order to make all the proteins that are used for various purposes by that cell. Just busy being itself during G1. When you get to S, That stands for S, our synthesis of DNA. That's when new DNA has to be created. And that's when the second function of DNA comes into play, replication. So DNA replication occurs during the S phase of interphase. And by the time you get there to the S phase, that cell has already gotten the signal or has determined that its normal lifetime is effectively over and the rest of its lifetime is going to be spent preparing to split into two. That first part of preparation for splitting is to replicate the whole genome, all the DNA, so that each of the two daughter cells, as they're called, will have a complete set of DNA. And then G2 is also not a true gap. There's a lot happening in G2 as well, including more transcription of DNA. But all of the stuff that's happening in G2 really is just preparation work for the actual splitting. That's interphase, the three parts of interphase. Then we have mitosis and cytokinesis as the two subphases of the mitotic phase. And mitosis, which we'll look at the particulars of in a second, is one major type of eukaryotic division. Cell division. So this mitosis happens only in eukaryotes, not in prokaryotes. Prokaryotes undergo cell division, but they don't undergo mitosis. And that's because mitosis is specifically division of the nucleus and its contents. Well, that should tell you right there that prokaryotes don't do this, right? Because prokaryotes don't have nuclei to divide. So mitosis is done only by eukaryotes. Cytokinesis is division of everything other than the nucleus. So the collective cytoplasm. Right? A eukaryotic cell has a nucleus and a cytoplasm. And to split the entire cell, you have to split both of those compartments. Mitosis is division of the nucleus. Cytokinesis is division of the cytoplasm. Now, that's the distinction between the two processes of cell division. But one of these two has to be a much more careful process than the other when the splitting occurs. And which one has to be much more careful? Which one of these two processes, mitosis and cytokinesis? Right. Why? Well, I don't disagree with that, but what do you mean? Why does it have to be so much more careful than the splitting of the cytoplasm? Yeah, in other words, both of those cells has to get exactly the complete genome. You can't just say, well, this looks like about half of the DNA, so you take this and you take the rest. Both have to not only get exactly half of the DNA, but they have to get a complete set of genes. All right, so one chromatid from each of the replicated chromosomes, in other words. Yeah. Yeah, that's one way that you can have mutation. And there's mutations at different levels that we'll talk about. That you're talking about a chromosomal mutation, and that's one way that can happen, yes. And we'll talk about that even more specifically in a little bit. So mitosis has to be very careful. On the other hand, cytokinesis doesn't have to be nearly as careful. It's okay to just roughly give half of the cytoplasm to one of the cells. You don't have to say, well, it looks like you have 20 mitochondria here, I'm going to make sure you get 10 and you get 10. Because as long as you get a full dose of DNA from mitosis, you can construct the other things that you need if you're deficient in any of it. And, you know, as long as you have one mitochondrion, mitochondria themselves split just like cells. And this is in keeping with the fact that they came from bacteria originally, right? They have their own DNA. They undergo their own division to create new ones. But you have to have all the genes, otherwise there will be proteins that you're incapable of making. And therefore, you won't survive, probably. Okay, so that's one cell cycle, all of that. Now, notice the stark black lines between G1 and S and G2 and so forth. But there is no black line between mitosis and cytokinesis. In fact, they use two different shades of yellow and kind of just blend into it. And that's not just lazy artwork. It represents the fact that mitosis and cytokinesis, even though they're different processes doing different things, they overlap each other in time. In other words, cytokinesis doesn't wait until mitosis is complete before it starts. Cytokinesis starts before mitosis ends, but mitosis starts first. All right. Let's go on to 5 then and look at the particulars of mitosis. This is actually a little bit more than mitosis that we're looking at here, because notice the left set of pictures is G2 of interphase. So this is this left edge is right before we get to the mitotic phase. The rest of it is the mitotic phase, which includes mitosis and cytokinesis. And you can see this overlap I was just talking about in the fact that telophase, which is the last part of mitosis, is shown together with cytokinesis. But G2 of interphase is shown here so we can compare what's happening in the cell then to what's happening throughout mitosis. So let's start with G2 of interphase. And each of these pictures, of course, comes in two versions, a colorized actual micrograph and a cartoon. The cartoon, when you're learning this, is easier and better to look at to understand the important events. But let's first see what we have in G2 of interphase before the mitotic phase starts. You have a nucleus without visible chromosomes in it. This is the diffuse chromatin I was talking about earlier. And it's starting to condense, so it's not as diffuse as it was in G1, for instance. But you can't see any individual pieces, so it's just called chromatin. The nuclear envelope, which is, of course, is the boundary that defines the nucleus, the double membrane, is intact still. So there is a distinct compartment called the nucleus still. Outside in the cytoplasm, you have two centrosomes. So think back to the tour of the cell chapter when we talked about centrosomes, which are pictured as these kind of yellow halos. But remember what I said they are. Centrosomes are microtubule organizing centers. So they're important parts of the cytoskeleton. That's what we talked about originally. But that cartoon that we looked at when I introduced centrosomes to you included only one centrosome in that cell. Here there are two. And that's because during the S phase, not only is the DNA replicated inside the nucleus, but also the centrosome gets doubled, it gets copied. So there are now two centrosomes. Also, these particular centrosomes that we're looking at in this example contain these licorice-looking T-shaped centrioles. So what does that tell you about the nature of this, or the origin of this cell? What kind of cell are we looking at? Everyone hear that? Don't be afraid to say something that's even if it's wrong. It's better than everyone else just sitting here. Well, yes, but more specific. What kind of cells have centrioles in their centrosomes? Animal cells, yes. Plant cells, remember, just to use another example of a eukaryote, have centrosomes, but their centrosomes don't include centrioles. Centrioles are the things I said we haven't figured out what the hell they do. We just know that animal cells have them and other eukaryotes don't. Okay, anyway, these two centrosomes now appear next to each other, notice, in G2. All right, that's how things are right before the mitotic phase. And the first part of the mitotic phase is mitosis, as we said. But what you didn't see in the detail in the circular schematic in the last slide is that mitosis itself, which is already a subphase of the mitotic phase, has five subphases within it. And those are listed here in the order in which they occur. Prophase, then prometaphase, then metaphase, then anaphase, and then telophase. All right. Let's go through these one at a time, mentioning what really defines them as far as the events occurring. Prophase is the first, and pro means before. Comparing this to G2, what we see in the nucleus is that the chromatin is coiled up a lot more than it had been already. So now you're starting to see individual pieces, but you're not able to tell exactly how many pieces there are, how many chromosomes that will eventually say there are, because we don't use the word chromosome, even though it's the same material, until we see them as distinct pieces. All right, but that occurs in prophase. And the nuclear envelope, notice, is still intact. So you still have a true nucleus separated from the cytoplasm. But in that cytoplasm, notice what's happening in prophase. The two centrosomes are sprouting microtubules, which makes sense because that's what they are. Centrosomes are microtubule organizing centers. That's where these long polymers are built. And the microtubules that are growing from each centrosome are pushing on each other, notice. And that is causing the centrosomes to polarize, which means that the centrosomes are moving to opposite ends of the cell, to the poles of the cell. The polarization of the centrosomes is not complete, but they're moving away from each other. And this overall yellow structure, which is the two centrosomes plus the microtubules that are growing from them, makes up what is called the mitotic spindle. A spindle is something that is wider in the middle and tapered at the ends, kind of like a football shape. And so this is the early mitotic spindle. It's going to get bigger and more complex. But that's prophase. Prometaphase is next. And we no longer have, at this point, a true nucleus, because the nuclear envelope has disintegrated in prometaphase. This is what happens in animal cells and other kinds of eukaryotes, but not all eukaryotes. The reason that the nuclear envelope has to disintegrate in animal cells is that it's in the way, basically. That's because the mitotic spindle is out in the cytoplasm, and the chromosomes, and now we can call them chromosomes because another thing that's happened is that the condensing of the chromatin has gotten to the point where you can see individual pieces now. But anyway, the mitotic spindle and its microtubules needs to interact with the chromosomes. Mitotic spindle's in the cytoplasm, the chromosomes are in the nucleus, and therefore the boundary between those two compartments, which is the nuclear envelope, needs to be disintegrated so that it's not impeding the process. Also, notice that the polarization of the mitotic spindle is now complete. The two centrosomes are on opposite ends. They're as polarized as they're going to get. The yellow strands, which are the microtubules growing from the centrosomes, are all, molecularly speaking, the same stuff. They're all the same kind of polymer. But we give two different names or two different categories of microtubules based on how they function within the mitotic spindle. One of those categories is kinetochore microtubules. You probably can't see the word from where you are, but kinetochore microtubules are named for the fact that they connect to places on the replicated chromosomes called kinetochores. So take a moment and look at the chromosomes. These are, first of all, properly called chromosomes because now we see them separate from each other. But they're also, notice, replicated chromosomes, each one consisting of two sister chromatids, just like that black and white photograph I showed you earlier. And that should make sense, right? Because when is replication occurring? Or when did it occur? It occurred in the S phase of interphase. That's when DNA synthesis is, which is replication. We're past that, right? G2 is after the S phase. So all of the chromatin is already doubled. And by the time it condenses into visible chromosomes, they are therefore replicated chromosomes. And each of these two sister chromatids within one replicated chromosome are identical to each other. Notice you might be able to see the black spots on each pair or each replicated chromosome. There are two black spots right at the connection point holding the two chromatids together. Remember that connection point holding the two chromatids together is called the centromere, but there are two black dots on the centromere. There's two sides to the centromere. Those black dots are kinetochores. So there's a kinetochore corresponding to one of the chromatids on the centromere, and there's a kinetochore corresponding to the other chromatid on that same centromere. And those are the connection points that the so-called kinetochore microtubules connect to. That's why those microtubules are called kinetochore microtubules. Notice, though, that some of these yellow microtubules are not connecting to kinetochores. And they are therefore called either non-kinetochore microtubules, like this book calls them, or they could be called polar microtubules. Call them either of those two. They refer to the same thing. Instead of connecting to kinetochores, the polar microtubules from the two different poles interact with each other. Those are the ones that were originally polarizing the centrosomes, and they're continuing to do that. So this is what not only can get the centrosomes to opposite ends, but if the non-kinetochore microtubules keep interacting, they can actually elongate the cell, which is part of splitting into two, preparing it to split into two. So that's the situation in prometaphase. Once all those connections are made, in other words, once every kinetochore on every replicated chromosome gets attached to a kinetochore microtubule, then the replicated chromosomes, which can be anywhere at the moment, can be moved after that connection is made to a place halfway between the two poles. And that's what defines the next phase, which is metaphase. Metaphase is the shortest of the phases because it's really only the time during which all of the replicated chromosomes are at the halfway point between poles. And it looks in this picture like they're lined up in one line. Actually, that doesn't have to be true, because this is a two-dimensional picture, right? But the real thing is three-dimensional. So if you have a geographic globe of the Earth, for instance, which is three-dimensional, what cuts through the equator is a plane, not a line, right? So they can be anywhere in that plane, not necessarily lined up, and still be halfway between the two poles. And that's really what's happening here. In fact, the imaginary plane that cuts through that halfway point is called the equatorial plate. It's not an actual structure, it's just a mathematical plane, imaginary plane. Okay, so that's metaphase. Now notice up to this point, nothing has split yet. That's about to change because anaphase is the next part of mitosis. And anaphase is when you have splitting occurring. What splits are the two sister chromatids, identical to each other, in each replicated chromosome. You can see that having already occurred here. This is identical to this. They used to be one replicated chromosome consisting of two sister chromatids. When the sister chromatids separate from each other, we change their name. We no longer call them chromatids. Now, because they're on their own, they're called chromosomes, but they're not replicated, right? They're just enough DNA for one cell, not for two. So one replicated chromosome consisting of two sister chromatids splits in anaphase into two unreplicated chromosomes, which this is calling them daughter chromosomes. It has nothing to do with gender. That's just what they chose to use as the word. Not only have they split, though, but notice that they are migrating toward one pole or the other. Now, this is a cell that has more than one chromosome. This is a species that has six different chromosomes. So there's these six daughter chromosomes are not identical to each other. They all came from different replicated chromosomes. But this batch is going to one pole, and this batch is going to the other pole. And that's, we'll see how this works in a minute, but notice that a requirement for this to happen successfully is attachment of those kinetochore microtubules to the kinetochores originally so that they can move to poles. All right, the last part of mitosis is telophase. Telo means far, like in telescope. That simply means that the migrating groups of daughter chromosomes get all the way to their destinations, which are the two poles. And therefore, at each pole, you have a collection of unreplicated chromosomes that becomes a new nucleus, because a nuclear envelope will form around each of the two groups of daughter chromosomes. Not only will the two nuclei form, but notice that even before the cell division has finished, these chromosomes that had been coiled, we were calling them chromosomes because they're so coiled up tightly, have already started to loosen so that their DNA codes can be used. I forgot, by the way, to mention that in metaphase, that condensing or coiling up of the chromatin is maximized. You'll never see chromosomes smaller than they are during metaphase. Then they start to loosen up even before the cell division is done. Now, for the moment, this is still one cell, technically, with two nuclei. But it's not going to remain as one cell long because cytokinesis has already begun. That's what I was talking about by the overlap between mitosis and cytokinesis. Specifically, telophase of mitosis overlaps cytokinesis. But Telophase is about what's happening to the nuclear contents, whereas cytokinesis is about division of the cytoplasm. And in an animal cell, cytokinesis occurs by the creation of what's called a cleavage furrow. To cleave means to split, and a furrow is just a ditch. So if you look at this in three dimensions, it looks like there's a ditch dug all the way around the equatorial plate, halfway between the two poles. And that cleavage furrow gets deeper and deeper until the two pieces pinch off from each other, and that's when you officially have two completely separate cells. And that's the end of one cell cycle, and each of those two cells will enter the beginning of its own cell cycle. Okay, six gives you a much better view to look at from where you're sitting of metaphase. So now you can clearly see that each replicated chromosome consists of two identical sister chromatids connected at a centromere, but the centromere features two sides, so it has two kinetochores. One kinetochore for each of the two sister chromatids, and those kinetochores are the connection points between the chromatid itself and a kinetochore microtubule. It also shows you in this perspective view that they don't have to be lined up, they just have to be in the same plane halfway between the two poles. And that plane is not an actual piece of glass. It is an imaginary plane called the equatorial plate. Seven. Well, I've already said that the connection of kinetochore microtubules to replicated chromosomes at kinetochores is a requirement for successful splitting. But it brings up the question of how this splitting and the subsequent migration of the daughter chromosomes to the poles happens. And there's any number of possibilities you could come up with, I guess, but there are two that really make a lot of sense. One is kind of like a hook and line hypothesis, analogous to fishing, right? You have a line, which is like a kinetochore microtubule with a hook at the end, and if you hook the fish, you then reel the line in, the fish comes along with it. So one possibility is that these kinetochore microtubules that have already hooked their chromatids, or daughter chromosomes once they split, get reeled in to the centrosome to bring them toward that pole. Another major hypothesis, though, that could make sense as well, is that instead of being reeled in, the kinetochores stay in place and just serve as roadways along which the daughter chromosomes can move toward the pole. And so what we're looking at here is really the results of an experiment to test which of those two hypotheses is incorrect. Because that's really all we can prove in science is the incorrect part. So what they did was chemically mark the mitotic spindle. You know, it looks like they took a black marker and marked it. That's not, of course, how they did it, but it's the same thing. Once you have this mark in place, now think about the two competing hypotheses that are being tested here. If it is the fishing hypothesis, then you would expect the mark to move toward the pole as it's reeled in. And you would expect the distance between the mark and the chromosomes to be constant, and they both move. On the other hand, if it's the roadways hypothesis, then you would expect the mark to stay in place. You would expect the chromosomes to approach and eventually pass the mark as they move along the roadways toward the pole. Well, that second thing is what actually ended up being the truth. The mark stayed in place. These things moved along the roadways until they got to the poles. And the bottom shows you why this happens. The kinetic ores that I keep talking about, one of which is shown here in teal, is a complex of proteins, including motor proteins in red. That's part of the kinetic ore. So each kinetic ore includes motor protein, just like the ones we've studied before. So you're already used to the fact that motor proteins have two legs that walk one step at a time along microtubules. That's what they do normally, not just in mitosis. I showed you that picture of one carrying a vesicle of whatever, containing whatever, moving it from one place into the cell to another. Well, here the cargo is not a vesicle. The cargo is what the kinetic ore is connected to, which is the daughter chromosome, a former chromatid, but chromosome after it split. So that's how they get to the poles. A normal road, when you think about it, still exists after you travel down it, right? So it can be used again by other people or you again. Well, this particular road, this kinetic ore microtubule, in other words, is a road that only has to be used once. It's never going to be used again, and therefore it doesn't need to still exist after it's used. And that's why as the motor protein walks along the microtubule and passes a point on that road, the part of the road behind it that's no longer going to be used gets disintegrated. It gets broken into the monomers that it was made out of originally and then recycled as material. And that's why it looks like they were being reeled in, because the roads are getting shorter, but they're not getting shorter because they're reeled in. They're getting shorter because they're destroyed behind the motor proteins. Now to 8. Everything we've talked about for mitosis and have seen in pictures so far has been using an animal as an example. And we see animal cytokinesis in the left part here. Well, mitosis, which is separate from cytokinesis, of course, occurs in a plant basically the same way it occurs in an animal cell. So all of that stuff in the figure that showed all the subphases of mitosis is true for animal and plant. But cytokinesis has to be different because of an important difference between animals and plants that we've talked about before. The animal cells do not have a cell wall. They have only the plasma membrane, which you already know is flimsy, and that's why hypotonicity can explode an animal cell, right? The flimsiness of the plasma membrane doesn't hold the pressure in. A plant cell, on the other hand, has a very thick cell wall exterior to the plasma membrane. And that means that you have to go about cytokinesis differently. But let's look at the detail of how it happens in an animal cell. This cleavage furrow that I was talking about before, that gets deeper and deeper, is really like cinching up the middle with a belt. Except usually when you use a belt, the belt loops are on the outside. But it would work if you had loops on the inside, right? Well, that's, you do actually have little proteins acting as belt loops inside. And this circular yellow thing is also a protein that makes a circle, overlaps itself a little bit. That's the belt or drawstring, and it starts to overlap more and more, so the circle gets smaller and smaller, and since it's through belt loops, it pulls inward, creating this cleavage furrow all the way around it. It gets deeper and deeper until it pinches off, and then you have two complete daughter cells. You can't do that with a plant cell, though, because the cell wall is too tough. So you don't have cleavage furrows form in plant cytokinesis. Instead, you have what's happening on the right side. Mitosis has already gone on in here. This is why, at the moment, you have two different nuclei in this one cell, just like you did for the animal one. It's not going to remain as one cell, though, because you have cytokinesis happening. But this one cell has one plasma membrane, which is the inner lining of this, you know, right against the cell wall, all the way around. And also remember that membrane material is membrane material. It's all pretty much the same stuff, phospholipid bilayer, which is why when it meets other membrane material, it fuses together so easily. All right. At the equatorial plate, which is the halfway point between the two poles, you have vesicles form. Now, we've talked about vesicles before, but they are little sacs made out of membrane, right? And they can contain various things. Well, these sacs, these vesicles, contain cell wall material. And the vesicles start out small and grow until they actually touch each other. And since the outside of each vesicle is membrane material, when the vesicles touch each other, the membrane coalesces. And that forms what's called a cell plate, which is not all the way across the length of the cell yet. But notice that the cell plate, the exterior of it, is membrane material, just like plasma membrane is. And the interior of it is cell wall material. It then grows even longer until the ends meet up with the plasma membrane on either end of the cell. And once again, membrane material fuses into membrane material. So now you have two plasma membranes, one here defining this cell and one here defining this cell, two separate cells at this point. Cytokinesis is complete. And between the two is the cell wall material that the vesicles contained originally. If they didn't rearrange themselves to get even bigger than after this, which does happen. But that's not part of cytokinesis anymore. Because once you have these two cells, then they can continue to add material as individual cells to get full size again, each. And that's where the growth comes for the overall plant, because that'll be happening in all the cells that are created. Slide 9 is plant mitosis. These are plant cells that you're looking at, real photomicrographs. And you'll be able to see something very similar to this through scopes when you look at onion root tips, for instance. You use a part of the plant that is actively growing, which root tips are, right? Roots are growing longer all the time. That's the perfect place to look at cells under the microscope, because in those hundreds of cells that make up that tip, it's very likely, since the tip is growing, that you'll find cells in various stages of mitosis. So you can easily find all five stages of mitosis. And they're just shown here in the order in which they occur. But like I said before, mitosis itself happens the same way in plants as in animals, so I'm not going to go through that again. The cytokinesis I was just talking about, though, is shown here. The cell plate is forming. It's not yet all the way across, though. And it's not called a cell plate once it gets all the way across. Then it's a cell wall. Cell plate is when it's almost all the way. That brings us to 10. And 10 features a bacterium as an example, prokaryote. Prokaryotes, of course, have DNA just like eukaryotes do. They just don't have a separate compartment, the nucleus, to contain that DNA. Well, they also reproduce by cell division. But, of course, it can't involve mitosis because they don't have a nucleus, which is what mitosis is the division of. Instead, prokaryotes, most of them divide using a method called binary fission. That's what we're looking at here. Binary simply means into two or involving two. And fission means splitting. A fissure is a split. like a fissure in a rock, for instance. Well, this sounds simple, and the cartoon looks simple, but it still needs to be a careful process, because the DNA first has to be replicated, just like it does for a eukaryote, and then it has one of the copies needs to be given to one cell and the other copy to the other before the splitting occurs. Now, this brings up another difference between prokaryotes and eukaryotes. Eukaryotic cells feature some number, and that number depends on the species, of chromosomes. Like for humans, it's 23 different chromosomes. There's things that have fewer, things that have more than we do. But it depends on the species. Some number of chromosomes, and the chromosomes for eukaryotic cells are linear, meaning that they have two ends, as you saw in the micrograph. But the DNA for a prokaryote is arranged into one chromosome that is not linear, it's ring-shaped. Or not necessarily, that doesn't appear as a circle, but it wraps back on itself. So what looks like a scramble of spaghetti here, originally, is, if you pulled it apart, would be one loop. That's one circular chromosome containing all of the genes that that cell uses. And so when replication comes, that one circular chromosome becomes two identical circular chromosomes. That's why it looks like there's more spaghetti here. But one loop goes to one daughter cell and the other one goes to the other. So that it achieves the same thing as mitosis and cytokinesis, but it's called binary fission for prokaryotes. Shows you binary fission at the top, but all the other ones here are eukaryotes. So the main point of this slide is that whereas eukaryotes undergo mitosis, the exact particulars of mitosis are not necessarily the same in all eukaryotes. I said it was the same in plants and animals. Those are only two groups within eukaryotes, right? There are fungi, there are protists, there's all kinds of different eukaryotes. Well, in dinoflagellates, notice that the nuclear envelope does not disintegrate like it does in animals and plants. And that's because it's not actually in the way, because it is perforated with holes through which the microtubules can pass to make the connections with the kinetochores. And in diatoms and yeasts, also you don't have disintegration of the nuclear envelope because the mitotic spindle actually forms inside the nucleus, so that there's no need to get rid of the nuclear envelope. It's not in the way as a connection between kinetochore microtubules and kinetochores. But for most major groups of eukaryotes, including us animals and plants, as I said, there is disintegration of the nuclear envelope. This, by the way, is an animal because you see the two centrioles. So they really shouldn't have drawn that since they said most eukaryotes. But anyway, that brings us to 12. And 12 really is a kind of a natural break in topics. So even though I have some minutes left, I think I'll stop there.